This is recorded on the morning of July the 9th, 1970, in the offices of Dean John C. Day.
Yes.
Dean of the School of Industrial Management and of the Krannert Graduate School of Industrial Administration at Purdue University. Professor Eccles of the History Department is interviewing Professor Day. This tape is made for the Purdue University Archives. To start out, Dean Day, in our usual format, will you tell us where you were born and your educational experiences and administrative experiences until you came to Purdue?
Right. I was born in Newton, Massachusetts, 1917, and lived in the Boston area all of my youthful life. Attended the Boston City Schools, graduating from Boston Technical High School. I went on from there to attend the engineering school at Tufts University for the first 2 years of my baccalaureate work.
When did you enter?
I entered Tufts in 1935.
It's out in Medford.
In Medford, Massachusetts, right. At the end of my second year, thoroughly unhappy with engineering studies, I asked the dean of the engineering school for a transfer to the liberal arts school. He was not at all happy about it, and as a result of some discussion, I left that spring at the end of the spring term rather disgruntled with both the dean and the school. During the summer, I met a friend of mine who was a friend of the family's who was teaching in a new venture, a new type of undergraduate school of business, which had been started by a rather interesting individual in Cambridge. And as a result of his rather intriguing discussion of something called cases, which I had never heard of before, I prevailed upon my family to allow me to enter this school in the fall. The name of the school was the Oxford School of Business Administration. It was a small private experiment, I guess is the best way you can describe it. I attended for 2 years, never did amass as a result of the engineering and the business courses what might be called a full four-year curriculum. But with the pressure of the times and the need to earn some money at the end of the fourth year, that's 2 years of engineering and 2 years of business, I took a position in a small manufacturing firm just up in Boston. While I was at Tufts, I had entered the platoon leader's class at in the Marine Corps, U.S. Marine Corps, and upon completion of my fourth year of study, I was awarded a second lieutenant's commission in the reserve. After working with a small manufacturing company for
what did it manufacture?
It was a manufacturer of specialty hardware, other types of small, shall we say, fixtures and fittings that are used in the building trade. It also did specialty work in marine hardware. I had the fun, actually, of working in some of the major warships that were being built at that time in Quincy, Massachusetts, installing some special fittings on them, later to see these warships in action several years later. In the spring of 1940, as we all know, the war in Europe had been on for 7 or 8 months, and I had been receiving notices from the Marine Corps suggesting that it would be an appropriate time for me to obtain some further training. all of which I had deposited in the wastebasket. However, in June, a new type of notice came in which said that although they still were not ordering people to active duty, it was probably going to happen sometime in the future. And when it did happen, there was a good chance that I would not be able to have the same length of training that I would have if I went in now. Accordingly, I went to the owner of the firm and said that I thought the time had come for me to go on active duty in view of this type of letter. And he gave me a leave of absence with the expectation I would return. So in August of 1940, I went to Quantico, Virginia, with the high hopes I would return at the end of 3 or 4 months of training. Of course, this did not happen. I was then in the Marine Corps until December of 1945. Shortly after I entered the Marine Corps, I married my sweetheart, who I had known since the freshman year of college, Barbara. During World War II, I served with the 1st Marine Division. In fact, I was one of the original officers who helped form it in Cuba in January of 1941. I had a number of positions from platoon leader, company commander, eventually regimental S1, S3, and then moved up to division and eventually became the senior assistant G3 of the 1st Marine Division, participating in several landings.
In the Pacific?
In the Pacific.
In the Pacific.
After 6 months in Cuba and 33 months in the Pacific, I came back to the United States in just before Christmas of 1944. I was assigned to Marine Corps headquarters as the assistant officer in charge of one of the sections in the G4 division, and was there when the war ended and I returned to civilian life.
What was your rank when you came off?
My rank was a major. I remained in the reserve and eventually retired as a full colonel.
A bird colonel. Marvelous.
The upon return from World War II, I, like most young men, had to decide just what kind of a career I wished to follow. I still was interested in business. I returned to my former company, talked with the proprietor there. It had expanded greatly during the war from being a small company employing a dozen, 15 people to one employing several hundred. And although we recognized that it would not continue at this size, it still seemed to have a fine future. I also was offered the opportunity to go to work for a major electronics firm. Several other interesting things developed, but I did return to my original employer and stayed with him for approximately a year.
And this is 1946?
This is in 1940, late December 45 of January 46. Or almost a year, I should say. In the late summer, early fall of 1946, I was once again asked if I wished to return to the Marine Corps and accept a permanent regular commission as a major. At the same time, the dean of this private school that I had attended in prior to World War II got in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in working as an instructor, teaching as an instructor in general management in the school. I had never thought of teaching before, But the idea rather appealed to me, since one of the most enjoyable parts of my work in the service was involved in some teaching functions that one would have from time to time. I seriously considered returning to active duty. It was a rather an attractive situation. What finally decided me against it, with the orders in my hands, actually, was the fact that I felt very strongly that a regular officer should be willing to, at any time, pick up stakes and move to wherever he was needed. And I really couldn't see myself, since I now had a second son, doing this kind of thing, at least doing it gracefully, and it seemed to me that was a requirement. I did accept the position in the private school. I taught for 2 years in the school at teaching loads, I might point out, which would be unbelievable to most of our faculty. Started out with 20 hours a week and finally did get it down to 15. The dean of the school was a classmate of Dean David, who at that time was dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Business. As I became more interested in teaching, it was clear to me that I would require advanced degrees. I recognized that Harvard was not at all upset, had never been upset particularly as to whether anyone had a baccalaureate or not, so long as they felt you could have the requisites to handle their program. On the other hand, they only admitted a handful of people each year on this basis, maybe half a dozen, out of an entering class of 500. I did apply, and I was accepted for the class beginning in 1948. The dean of the private school was very anxious to have me continue to teach on a part-time basis, and although it was strongly recommended that I not do so by the people at Harvard, I nevertheless continued my teaching association with the private
You carried
school.
A full-time load in business school?
My 2 years of the business school were relatively uneventful, with the exception that there was the problem of maintaining a home and feeding my wife and two children, which my wife helped out a great deal by accepting a job as secretary of the academic dean of the junior college that was nearby in Newton, where we lived.
Was that
LaSalle.
By any chance LaSalle? I was just going to guess LaSalle.
And the 2 years, as I say, went by rather quickly. I was fortunate enough to make the Baker Scholar group. And as I approached graduation, I had to face again whether I wished to continue in industry or whether I wished to stay in teaching. I had several opportunities to go into industry, none of which really excited me, in part because of my age, which was then around 30, and the tendency of most firms that I talked with to, shall we say, wish to start me at the same age, in the same position as a person 25. Meanwhile, one of the professors, Professor Christensen, at the Harvard Business School, asked whether or not I had ever thought of continuing possibly with them, and of course that I had not really given it very serious consideration. As a matter of fact, I felt that teaching in that environment would be rather a traumatic experience, having watched various faculty members being decimated and pulled apart by 100 extremely bright young men who gave no mercy if the faculty member made one slip.
I was under the impression, though, that really is what makes Harvard Business School great. It's a republic a completely democratic republic of the intellect. If you can't take it, don't play.
I think that's right, and I think it's a little frightening when one recognizes that about the only thing you have over these young men is training and experience, that they're just as bright as you are. Of course, this is true of any good graduate program.
Is this what makes the case study system go, you think?
Well, the case study system is limping now in some areas because people don't really know what the case study system is all about. People are trying to use it without recognizing that it was never designed for the faculty member to be purely a moderator. This is what most people believe. The simple fact of the matter is the faculty member is a professor and is expected to, at the appropriate time, and the word appropriate has to be underlined, make his contribution. Now, there are those who understand this but are unable to find the appropriate time, and they end up lecturing, which of course kills the case method.
You have put into words my objection to Harvard Law School. I got the Endicott Peabody Salt installed to Harvard Law School and left for exactly that reason. Excuse me, I interrupted
you. I'm glad
you did. Let's get back to...
Well, at any rate, you're coming
to business school.
The end result of all of this was that I went down what I thought was going to be a middle path. I thought I was in the process of accepting a position with a medium-sized consulting company in Boston that specialized in production management consulting.
Had this been your specialty in business school?
Insofar as anybody has a specialty in business
school,
it would be the production management area, as we knew it then in 1950. I might point out it's quite different in 1970. The end result of all this was a period of negotiation of several weeks in which I interviewed all of the partners of the firm. There were four. Made out marvelously with three. The fourth man, who was in charge of their marketing branch, and I locked horns. And approximately 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, after apparently much consultation on their part, the decision was made not to offer me the position. The end result to me was that I felt left a little bit high and dry. I then asked at the business school whether their former interest was at all continuous, and they said, oh yes, and shortly thereafter I accepted the position as a research assistant at the Harvard on the junior faculty. I must emphasize the word junior, on the junior faculty at the Harvard Business School. My first assignment was to work with professor, then assistant professor, Bob Anthony. Bob was one of the whiz kids during World War II, a good friend of McNamara, and I was working in the area of managerial accounting. Bob had just undertaken a research project to study the control systems in their broadest aspects used in research laboratories. And I was assigned to do a good deal of the field work in these laboratories to try and determine how it was that the management's desires ended up by getting the kinds of research accomplished that the company wanted. It was a fascinating 4 or 5 months. I visited a number of important laboratories in this country, and I thought our work was progressing very nicely, and I think Bob agreed. However, the Korean War, which of course had started that June, intruded. And by late fall of 1950, the Defense Department was in considerable turmoil because President Truman had told the Director of Mobilization Analysis, that he was very much disturbed with apparently the inability of the Defense Department at that time to present the kinds of figures on mobilization which he felt made sense. The director of mobilization was a former graduate, was a graduate of the Harvard Business School, had a number of friends on the faculty, and had called upon Harvard for help in trying to analyze the situation regarding mobilization. The Graduate School of Business formed a task force consisting of about 20 faculty members under the direction of the Professor Baker, who later became Dean of the Harvard, of Harvard Business School, to tackle this problem. I was assigned with Professor Anthony to the Navy team, consisting of five people, and we spent the winter of 1951 in Washington, coming home occasionally on weekends, studying the problems of mobilization and the computation, the method of computation, the approach that had been used by the Defense Department. That in itself is an interesting story, which we don't have to go into here. This, of course, put us back in our work by 6 months. The following spring, Professor Anthony and I agreed that we would continue to work together for the summer, but that he would relinquish me at the end of the summer become involved in some other activity, since he would have been overstaying my original assignment by 3 or 4 months. As a byline to this, I'd like to put in here, I suppose, for posterity, that one of our jokes that we had while working in Washington was our salary. I think that we tend to forget what's happened to salary schedules over the years. I was employed as a research assistant at the sum of $2,700 per 12 months appointment. Now, because I was fortunate enough to have a wife and some children, Harvard increased this $300 for the wife and $300 for the children, so I was working at $3,300. I was a relatively well-paid research assistant. Another colleague of mine, who did not have a wife and child, was $2,700, working in Washington with top secret clearance, talking with nothing less than major generals in the Marine Corps and vice admirals in the Navy, privy to the chief of staff's files and what have you, with a pay scale which we discovered fell on the governmental scale, GS scale, at what we figure as GS 1.5, namely somewhere between a janitor and a sweeper. In the fall, I was asked whether or not I wished to do research, case collection actually, in the area of my major field, production management, or in another course which was headed by one of the team captains that had gone to Washington with us on small business management. As indicated earlier, I had worked in the small business. The private school had all of the problems of a small business, and I probably knew as much about it as anyone on the faculty. I decided to accept the small business appointment and did work hand in glove for the next year with this faculty member on developing this course and restructuring it and what have you. It's as a sidelight, it's rather interesting to note that this faculty member, of course, with whom I became quite friendly, after 1 year of teaching small business, said that he couldn't take it any longer. He wasn't really interested in widgets, and as a matter of fact, he wasn't sure he was interested in education, and left the school to accept a position with a major consulting firm. He is now president of Atlantic Richfield. The following year, a new faculty member took over the course. I was asked again by the production people if I would come into their group work with them. The dean requested that I stay, if I thought I could, in the small business to provide some transition for this new faculty member. I agreed to stay. He was an extremely interesting person. He, along with a professor from MIT, had invented, if invented is the correct word, a new type of safe airplane, the so-called helioplane, which today is considered perhaps the best STOL, that is short takeoff and landing aircraft in the country, and is widely used both by our government and missionaries. It's the favorite plane of missionaries in Africa and South America. However, he was engaged in a knockdown, drag-out battle with the United States Air Force, for whom he had been building some experimental models, and believed as a result of this he had been seriously underpaid. And I ended up by having much of the responsibility for the small business management course. Incidentally, as you might expect, students felt a little cheated by this. He was rather a famous small businessman, and it was his now research associate teaching the course. That year I was promoted to assistant professor and asked to whether or not I was interested in the possibility of doing a research project which did tie in with my small business interests in the field of subcontracting in the aviation industry. I accepted this assignment, and the following year was full-time on research, working on this project along with another man who was doing I was doing it on policy in subcontracting. He was doing it on financial control in subcontracting. It's impossible to talk about subcontracting without getting involved in some of the financial aspects of it. And at the end of the year of research, the question was asked whether or not I would like to teach in the finance area. Finance had not been my field, except by, shall we say, osmosis. Nevertheless, the idea was very appealing to me, since the result of my research, I began to see some of the problems in maintaining and operating a financial structure in a major corporation. So for the next 2 years, I taught in the first year finance program at Harvard, I think got to know a number of people in the field. I still maintain my interest in small business, as one might expect, working closely with the professor who took over that course after Professor Pollinger resigned to remain head up as president of the Helio Airplane Company. All during this, shortly after becoming a research assistant, I had registered for doctoral work at the Harvard Business School. The doctoral program at the business school was European in philosophy, in that it was pretty much an apprentice sitting at the knee of a major professor. There were of course formal requirements. There were, of course, the examinations, written and oral. But the real guts of the program was that you worked with a professor and worked closely with. I worked with a professor by the name of Robert Merry, who was involved in the policy area, since clearly I was going to use much of what I had collected in my research in policy on subcontracting the airframe industry. He seemed like a very appropriate, and also his interest was, I might put it, in manufacturing, and there were manufacturing overtones too. In the early part of 1956, it became apparent to me that I was going to have to face the real question, since I was finishing my degree, where I would go from there. I talked with the dean. In the finance field, they are extremely well staffed. The private college faces the problem of so many slots up ahead, and there seemed to be nothing there. And the production field, since I had sort of cut my nose off by spending so much time in small business and finance, I had not developed the continued the expertise that I had in 1950. Essentially, I was 5 or 6 years out of the field. I still was not sure at that time I wanted to be in education. I enjoyed it. I had been doing, all during this period, I should point out, a good deal of consulting work for a firm which was based in Cambridge. In fact, I think every year I did some consulting work. The last year I had done consulting work with two firms. I rather enjoyed that work, and when it was discovered that I was looking about and trying to make up my mind as to where I'd be going, rather than accepting a long-range assistant professorship at Harvard, which I had at that time, I was offered a position in the firm. I also looked at industry, was offered a position as production manager of a good-sized company in New York, and I looked at several opportunities, one of which was Purdue. In the academic field.
Who was the first person from Purdue to contact you?
Dean Weiler and Ron Stuckey had...
Now Stuckey, for the record, is spelled S-T-U-C-K-E-Y, is that right?
Right.
Right.
Had paid a visit to Harvard Business School during the early winter of 1956. They had told us, several of us, or a number of people actually, at the school about their plans to establish a school of industrial management at Purdue and the wonderful opportunities that would be available to anybody who got in the ground floor of this new department. I should correct that and say they were talking about a new department of industrial.
We went off the tape for a moment. All right, we were now back, and you were discussing your contacts with Weiler and with Stuckey, and you're coming to Purdue.
I was, as I mentioned, I was looking at several schools and had offers from a couple of them. Not really, in my opinion, very exciting kinds of things that I had already been doing at Harvard. And I was leaning very strongly towards accepting the position with a consulting firm, which, as I say, was based in Boston, and would have meant no change in my living habits or family or what have you. I suppose my decision finally to come to Purdue was a result of two factors that I hadn't really counted on initially. One was that Dean Weiler and Ron Stuckey were rather successful in their sales approach and were able to convince Dr. John C., who is on our faculty now, and Dr. Jim Parks, who was on the faculty.
He was your railroad man, wasn't
right,
he?
But is now a distinguished professor at the University of Mississippi, to come to Purdue. John C. Was with one of the major public accounting firms at that time in Boston, Librand Ross Brothers, and was taking his doctorate on a part-time basis on the side, and was finishing it up about the same, slightly behind me. Jim Pax was on leave of absence from the University of Mississippi doing research in railroad work for George Baker at Harvard. And the more I thought of the idea of three of us going to Purdue as a group, working together as a group, the more exciting it became. The second factor was the result of a series of tests that I took for a position in the company. They were very, very complete. I spent all day with both psychologists and psychiatrists. And then in a later date, returned and with sort of a feet up on the desk kind of session, talked with the head of the test group. He himself was a professor. Before we got done talking, he really summed it up by saying, "I don't understand why, with an opportunity like you have at Purdue, you would be at all interested in going into industry. We have strongly recommended the company hire you, and you will receive an offer from the company, I feel sure, but I don't think you're going to be very happy there, because the kind of people you prefer to work with are not the kinds of people you're going to find in that company or in most companies. At least this is what's based on our test." With these two factors in front of me, sort of staring me in the face, I did finally elect to come to Purdue. I should mention at this time I had no idea about Purdue.
Now, what year was this?
This was in 1956.
1956.
I had no idea of its program.
What was your rank? Professor, associate professor?
Oh, no, I was assistant professor. The offer was an associate professor at that time. I think that brings us up to date to my arrival at Purdue, which was in the summer of 1956.
All right. Now let us divide our discussion now into two parts. You are now established chronologically at Purdue in 1956. Will you discuss your courses and your teaching and research? Then we can come back and discuss your administrative advancement and change.
I was brought to Purdue, charged with developing the course in financial management for a new master's program, which had been voted by the faculty and the trustees, I believe, the previous year. I think to set the stage, I have to point out that the new Department of Industrial Management was located in 1956 in the schools of engineering under what was called the School of Industrial Engineering and Management. The other department in this school was, of course, the Department of Industrial Engineering. There was no head of this particular school. Professor Amrine served as head of the Department of Industrial Engineering. Professor Weiler, or Dean Weiler, later, served not only as the head of this Department of Industrial Management, but also as the head of the Department of Economics. The strange thing about our location was that we were responsible to the faculty of the schools of engineering for promotion, but responsible to the dean of the School of Humanities, Social Science, and Education, as it is now called, for budget.
This really was the era of change, when they were beginning to change.
Right. And so I guess one might say that we were in the unenviable position of having to satisfy two faculties, and I might point out two quite different faculties. I discovered upon arrival that Professors C and Pax would not be on board until January of 1957. quite rightfully, they had decided, after further discussion with Dean Weiler, that it would be to the advantage of both the university, Drew University, and themselves, if they completed their doctorate before arriving, and the January date in their case would be a much better one for them. I immediately, Ron Stuckey, who at that time was an associate professor in the school and assistant department head, had transferred to the school, Department of Industrial Management from the Department of Agricultural Economics that year. Ron himself had done his undergraduate work in agriculture at Purdue, had gone to Harvard and obtained his MBA, had returned to Purdue and received his PhD in agricultural economics shortly before this time. It was in part through Ron's urging that Dean Weiler became interested in establishing this Department of Management with its program the previous year. Ron Stuckey had, working with the faculty members on board in the Department of Economics, with some help from industrial engineering and psychology, had conceived this particular program for which I had been hired to teach. Essentially, it had, as one might expect with Ron's background and experience, heavy overtones of the Harvard Business School MBA program. After my arrival, however, I was able to make some inputs into this program to suggest some changes which were acted upon by the faculty prior to our actually accepting our first student. The first students were due to arrive in the fall of 57. They did. Parenthetically, I should point out the program I am talking about is the Master of Science in Industrial Administration program. It was the only program of the department. We were the only department on the campus that had a graduate program without any undergraduate program. Because of the fact that Professor C, who was going to teach managerial accounting, or financial control as we call it, would not arrive till January, I undertook to teach this course the first term, first time through, since it is so closely related to finance. In the spring, I taught the finance course. At the undergraduate level, I was teaching in finance, as one might be expected, and another area of interest of mine, the industrial relations course. Also, a general business management course that had been offered for many years by the students in agricultural economics. For the next 2 years, I was heavily involved in teaching primarily finance, business policy, in the master's program in management. I also accepted responsibility as head of the Industrial Management Policy Committee, which as chairman is the nearest thing we had to a department head. I point out that Dean Weiler was still carried the title as department head, but nearly all of the planning for curriculum, course changes, coursework were the responsibility of the committee which I headed. In 1958, the School of Industrial Management came into being. Originally, the concept was that it would be the School of Industrial Engineering and Management, which was the original title of it, would be set up as a separate entity reporting directly to the president with its own dean. However, at the last moment, the Industrial Engineering faculty decided they would prefer to stay in the Schools of Engineering. The school came into being with the Department of Economics, which decided they wanted to be in the school along with the Department of Management. At that time, we decided to move forward and establish our own undergraduate program awarding a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management. During this period, much of my research had been in the area of case development and case work, which resulted in the publication of a case book in 1959-1960. In the spring of 1959, the Ford Foundation announced a postdoctoral program for faculty members in business to, shall we say, review the changes which had gone on in business management education, particularly business management research, with the introduction of certain mathematical techniques for research and analysis. This program was to be offered at Harvard Business School with the support of the faculties of Harvard and MIT, plus some additional faculty members brought in from other areas. I was fortunate enough to be selected as one of the 40 participants in this program from all over the country, and accordingly was granted leave of absence by the university to attend. At the same time, which was the spring of 1959, I was promoted to full professor.
Is this the time when Doc Owen said Harvard tried to get you back?
I don't think so. No. I really don't know. There were many opportunities to leave Purdue, but I don't recall that Harvard was one of them. I think there was an opportunity, of course, after I was there. It was one of the old stories to go elsewhere, but it was not Harvard.
Yeah.
Thus, as full professor, I went on leave of absence for a year, beginning the fall of 59 to the August of 1960, to attend this program. When it was all over, I suspect as I look back on it now, the major contribution that this program made to me, to Purdue, was not to my development, but rather to place me in contact with some very fine faculty members whom we now have on the Purdue faculty. Professor Robert Johnson, who is probably the outstanding man of consumer finance in the United States today, is involved with presidential committees and Congress to the point where Professor Frank Bass, who considered one of the outstanding marketing research people in the United States, Edgar Pessima, who is likewise a distinguished marketing research person with special emphasis over the consumer side. While at Harvard, Dean Weiler contacted me, said that he had been giving a great deal of thought to the organization of the school. Ron Stuckey, who had been moved up to associate dean, become heavily involved in external kinds of affairs of the school and in the graduate students program in the school, but had not apparently been, providing the necessary relationships that M felt had to be provided with the individual faculty members. since we did not have a department head structure, in other words, the Department of Economics and the Department had no department head.
Still run by committees.
It was still run pretty much by committees.
Yeah.
This left a very wide administrative gap between the dean and the faculty. And the upshot of it was he asked me to accept the associate deanship for faculty beginning with the fall. After a lot of thought, since it seemed to me I was now in a unique position to really get involved in some of the things that I wanted to get involved in the area of finance and small business and business policy, I finally decided to accept the appointment and return to Purdue with that title and responsibility. I think that pretty much brings us up to date.
That was 1960.
That was the fall of 1960. Right?
Now, you continued to teach and to be an associate dean from 1960 to when were you appointed dean?
Well, actually, I didn't continue to teach all that time. When I returned, I accepted a half-time teaching assignment in the master's program for the first year. I rapidly discovered that without the department head structure, I essentially was fulfilling the department head responsibility for two departments, plus certain school responsibilities as associate dean. And the pressure on me during the working day was so great that I was having real difficulty in providing any time for students to get in the door, to say nothing of preparation for class. At the end of the year, I made the decision that I could either forget the open door policy, which I was very supportive of, and essentially closet myself away part of the time, like any professor should do, teaching graduate students, or I had to get out of the business of teaching graduate students. So still desiring to teach, the following year I accepted. Changed my assignment and took over teaching a small business management course, which is a 500 level, primarily on seniors, however, take it as an elective basis. I offered that course for, I think, the next 2 years. School was growing. Our doctoral program was becoming quite large. We had a major grant from the Ford Foundation, which encouraged this type of work. More and more, it became apparent that my classroom activity consisted of walking in the door and leading a case discussion or giving a lecture, which I find rather a sterile way of handling that kind of responsibility. I think it was brought home fully to me when I discovered that in the spring term, I believe it was, of 1962 or 63, I had been able to attend no more than 50% of the classes. And one of the students had come in and resigned from the class, and very quietly told me, although my graduate student assistant was doing an excellent job, he didn't pay his money to come listen to a graduate student assistant and a 500 level course. And of course, he was quite correct. At that time, I thought the best thing I could do was to try and find a faculty member of sufficient qualifications to handle this course. And I am very happy to say that Professor Arnold Cooper, who's on our faculty now, not only handled it, but has done it so much better that he's made the course, shall we say, known throughout the university. So beginning, I think it was in 64, I, for the first time, was a full-time administrator charged with internal responsibility in school. Dean Weiler has always advocated almost complete delegation once he feels that a person has reached the point that they can accept it. And by 1964, he had gradually passed over more and more of the reins for the internal operation of the school to such an extent that he consistently use the term that we are co-deans, with you running the internal affairs of the schools, while I will devote my time to the external activities.
What we call promotion, such as getting money, grants, scholarships.
Right, and
contacts.
With one exception, that he quite rightfully, and I insist upon doing the same thing, maintained the relationship between our school and the president, and that was always very well
understood. Now let me ask at this point, when did you become dean formally?
I became dean formally on February 1 of 1969.
Okay. All right. Now, there's an obvious question that's coming up. You've been here, really, from the beginning of the Industrial Management School. How do you rate its growth, and how do you rate the school in comparison with other schools of business and industry studies in the United States?
Well, of course I'm biased, as
we
one might expect.
That.
However, I have seen some unbiased, reasonably unbiased kinds of accounts. I suspect they're all biased one way or another, depending upon who puts them together. Some years back, were rated by a study done by the Chicago Tribune as one of the top 10 schools of business, graduate schools of business in the country. I would not say that that rating would be accepted by the majority of people who are in the who are interested in graduate business education, whether they be company recruiters or faculty in other schools. I would say, however, without doubt, that we would consistently be rated in the top 15 schools of business in the country.
Now, in what areas are we strongest and what areas are we weakest in order to get this rating?
We would be strongest in what I would call the use of disciplines in the teaching of business administration and management. In other words, our work in quantitative methods, statistics, computer science, sort of sets us apart from most other schools. Not because what we offer is not offered by other schools, but because we insist all our students have this kind of basic knowledge
in other words, to do come to Purdue, they should have some statistical ability that, say, going to Indiana Business School, they would not have to have.
Not statistical, but they must have a minimum of two terms of calculus, which pretty much means that any student we have enter our master's program in management is either an engineer or a science major.
Yes.
Secondly, I suppose you can say we are differentiated, and we are well known by this fact, that our input, our raw material, is so homogeneous. The typical school of business will have between 40% and 50% of its entering students, undergraduate engineers and scientists. We have 95%. We have the highest percentage of engineer and scientists in our master's program of any school in the
United
States.
Now, as I remember, this was tailored from the very beginning to serve this clientele.
The original philosophy of this particular program, this master's program, was that it would be a way for an engineer or a scientist to obtain in a relatively short time, one calendar year versus the two academic years that are normally required for the master's degree, a solid foundation in general management theory and practice. Now notice I say a solid foundation. We make no attempt to provide a specialty our men are not expected to be considered a specialist in marketing or a specialist in finance, as compared with the other other programs around the country where students do major. For example, I majored when I was at Harvard. It seems to me that as I look back at the various kinds of ratings that come along, we do pretty consistently fall in this top 15. For example, several years ago, one of the major graduate schools of business decided that it wanted to exchange information about recruiting practices for faculty and salary and so forth with those schools that it felt it competed with most closely for these types of people. Accordingly, they developed a list of 10 schools, which, including themselves, which they sent out questionnaires. The following year, it was also agreed that each year a different school would accept responsibility for sending out the questionnaires. The following year, another major school of business, who was one of the original 10, refused to limit it to 10. They insisted that two other schools be included, whom they felt they competed with strongly and who had the kinds of faculty that they would like to have on their school, on their faculty. And that year, the second year, this particular school requested Purdue and one other. I do not know what the second was, be added. So we are now one of 12 schools that who feel that its faculty are of a quality which makes it possible to compare such things as recruiting practices, salaries, fringe benefits, and so forth. I might point out that this includes schools like Stanford, Harvard, and others that are well-known.
In other words, you feel that Purdue has quickly come into the big leagues.
That's right. The only other school in the country that has ever made it this way, this rapidly, was Carnegie Mellon.
And Pittsburgh.
Not the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon.
I am interested in this because, as you know, the academic world plays games of which is better and who is who. And the last report I saw was that you had that there are certain areas in which we are best. For example, Professor Papke is known internationally, isn't he, for his studies in taxation.
I should mention, of course, that when I'm talking now about the master's program in management.
I see.
At the same time that this phenomenon was occurring, the Department of Economics, which was essentially non-existent in 1950, moved to in Carter's report, moved up into the 18th or 19th place, which is an enormous stride when you consider the kinds of competition.
When I remember coming to Purdue, we had a Department of Economics composed of people who were teaching elementary courses. One or two men were known off the campus, I think three men, and of that group, not a one of them had improved, I think, in his, well, one had. But I don't believe of those three men, two of them had thought much about their subject and has changed since 1910.
Well,
this is remarkable, isn't it? Who this? You and M together?
Well, no, the Department of Economics was really up until I would say about 1963 or 64 was M's complete responsibility.
I see. Yes.
I did nothing in the recruiting in that area. Early 1960s, I began to get involved in recruiting and recruited, of course, right on through until I became dean. The Department of Economics had just an enormous growth. In fact, it's in both in quality and size, and it's later on, as we look back on it, its success in a sense had some impact on what happened in the last 3 or 4 years by bringing in extremely bright assistant professors from the best schools in the United States. Dean Weiler created a block of young men who were rising together. And suddenly, after 7, 8, well, more than that, maybe say 10 years, all of these bright young assistant professors became full professors. And
you're thinking people like Lance Davis.
I'm thinking of Lance Davis,
John Hughes,
Stan Ryder, Vernon Smith, you name it, men whose names were well known outside of Purdue. In fact, Purdue was the locus of the new approach to economic history, in which statistics plays a major part of analysis. And under Davis and Hughes's direction, aided and abetted by some of the econometricians, such as Ryder.
The only trouble I find with their program is the horrible title they chose, Cleometrics, of all things.
Well, that was sort of a joke, as you well know.
I know it was.
But at any rate, what happened several years ago was that as these men rose to full professorship, for a whole variety of reasons, they began to look for new fields to conquer. It's interesting to see that some of them have tried to replicate, as they moved to other institutions, what they had at Purdue. The end result of all of this is that a group of young men of about the same age, arriving at the full professorship within 2 or 3 years of one another, all decided at about the same time to seek little empires of their own. And since they were all of the same age, they all left about the same time, and we found ourselves in the process of rebuilding a new Department of Economics.
Isn't this roughly what happens in almost any school? It goes up and down and changes in the course of 10 years?
This is right. I think that you get cycles. The famous institutions, the old institutions, by their very momentum, camouflage much of this. And information is always 5 years behind actual events in most of these schools. And by the time the information gets out, they're already in the new cycle and can point to new progress. And therefore, the effect of this adverse publicity tends to be dampened by them being able to say, well, look what we're doing now,
yes,
kind of thing. But
has this been your big headache, your largest headache, is personnel and maintaining quality?
Yes, I think it is. I think the problem of maintaining personnel hasn't been so much a problem of maintaining quality as it has of maintaining the reputation, which is quite a different kind of thing. A full professor leaves you, he's well known, he may very well for the last several years not have been making a great contribution for any one of a number of reasons, or he may have, but no way to forecast this. You bring in a bright, young, eager person who's fully as bright, or fully as able, doesn't have the experience, doesn't have the name. And from the viewpoint of the student looking at your school, or the viewpoint of another faculty member, they flip their finger down the catalog and say, oh my, no one here I recognize. The simple fact of the matter is you may have replaced an extremely bright, able full professor who hasn't been working for a year or so by a man who's going to work like a beaver for the next 5. But that has nothing to do with the fame of the individual. As of the time the person was looking
at. You select your graduate school by who is there.
This is essentially what the students do, and clearly when the names move on elsewhere, this has some impact upon the type of graduate student who will apply to your school. Now, I would say that maintaining quality hasn't been the problem. Maintaining reputation in the Department of Economics has. The management side has been growing steadily in reputation, and we have not as yet had this problem. Our management faculty have had some tremendous offers, and we have frankly have not been able to meet them the monetary standards.
Well, to mention one, is Dick Walton an example?
Well, Dick Walton is an example of a man who had a plan, a career plan, and his career plan was to use Purdue University as a basis for developing a reputation that would stand him in good stead nationally.
There's nothing wrong with this.
And there's nothing wrong with this. I knew this. We accepted it. There came a time when Harvard offered Dick a position. Dick refused to accept the position unless it was fully equal in dollars and free time for research and all the other prerequisites that go with a senior faculty position to what he had at Purdue.
Of course, this says a great deal for Purdue's reputation, doesn't it?
Yes.
He's now at Harvard.
He accepted the position at Harvard. They could not match Purdue's salary. However, they were able to provide him with a permanent consulting contract with an industrial firm, which made it more than possible to match Purdue's salary. There was one time we have a faculty member returning to us from a leave of absence teaching at Harvard Business School this last year. He's been offered a position at Harvard. In fact, he's been offered the position three times. Has turned it down each time, in part because his philosophy is the same, I think, as Dick's, that when he gets to be full professor with a rather complete reputation, which he's building very rapidly, then he'll look around. Until then, he feels Purdue is the best place to build it.
This is a very enviable position for Purdue to be in, is it not?
In our School of Management, we are in a very enviable position. Our Department of Management, I should say. Economics, of course, we don't quite have this now as a result of some of our senior people leaving.
It will come. Now, we were... I thought your problem might... the basic problem. Let's just for a moment touch on the executive building. Is there any particular problem or block any problem that you've discovered in the executive building that makes it tough? I'm talking about the trustees and Hupti and the vice presidents.
I would say that like every organization, we have some of our problems. Many of these, I think, are problems which more due to organizational structure than they are to the people who inhabit the particular positions. President Hubdi, whom I admire very much, has always insisted that the deans have free access to him at any time. Clearly this has had impact upon responsibilities.
We must stop for a moment. All right, Dean Day, we're back on the... our discussion was interrupted about policies in connection with your job and that in the executive building, and anything that you would like to add to what you've said.
I think the future will require us to develop our top level of administration in such a way that the president will be freed, from what would amount, what I would claim to be some of the details that perhaps could be better handled by the vice presidential level. Now, this may mean that the university will require someone to fill the role of provost or chancellor or whatever you want to call them, who will have, as I had some years back as associate dean, almost complete responsibility for handling the internal affairs of the university. That doesn't mean that the president will not, from time to time, be forced to make a decision to step in. But when he does, it'll be very clear that the decision is so great and so important that only he can handle it. Otherwise, I think the job of the president becomes intolerable and cannot be carried by anyone there.
This is really then part of the growth of Purdue from a small school to a very large one.
Right, and it is... Someone once asked me, why do you advocate a course in small business management when, after all, the theories that are being applied in marketing, shall we say, finance, production, are exactly the same for the large firm as the small? And of course my answer to that was, you're right, they are the same, but you did use the word apply, and the problem of application is so much different. The questions which arise in the small business have such a completely different orientation. Even though the basic theory is the same, you have a whole new ball game. The same thing has happened to Purdue.
Let me ask, is there anything in your calculation from where you sit as dean of the industrial management complex of working in with directing work in developing campuses and serving the state of Indiana? Now, everybody I've talked to here says Purdue's primary objective, is education. But they always emphasize this is a great land-grant school and we must serve Indiana first.
I happen to believe rather strongly that the university, Purdue University, and Indiana University, Ball State and Indiana State for that matter, have accepted, when the legislature votes them funds, a major responsibility for the education first of Indiana students. Clearly we also receive federal funds which come from the general taxpayers of the country, and we have some other responsibilities there. Now, I don't think, as I mentioned earlier, just a moment ago, I don't think Purdue has this responsibility alone. There are other schools which have equal responsibilities. So I suppose we say the state system has this responsibility. Our real problem is we have not defined, it seems to me, within the state, who does what and where.
That is, in a sense, you're competing with Indiana.
I'm not competing with Indiana, but what I am doing is paralleling Indiana. I'm not competing in the sense that if I give up the work I'm doing, Indiana has got to turn around and add new faculty members, new buildings, and new to handle it. We're in the position where there are a sufficient number of customers, shall we say, that whoever handles them is going to have the facilities or add-on facilities, and the other person gives it up. There is, however, competition in some areas, and when people are out trying to buy students one from another, then the competition becomes very real.
In other words, there's not there is a distinguishing difference in your mission and, let's say, that of Indiana Business School.
Well, there is a distinguishing mission, I think, to the extent that we have emphasized a certain specialty, that of educating engineers. There's no difference in the mission, let's say, of the Department of Economics at Indiana and the Department of Economics at Purdue. So happens that the Department of Economics at Purdue happens to believe more in quantitative analysis than the Department of Economics in Indiana, but that doesn't mean their missions are different. There are some the concept that all schools need basic work in humanities and social sciences and science is fine, and therefore this means that there is no competition. My guess is there's probably greater competition between the Department of English at Purdue and the Department of English at Indiana for a top PhD than there is between the business school in Indiana and the business school at Purdue for an MBA.
While we're on this for a moment, would you care to rate business schools in the Big Ten?
Well, of course, I will say this, that Indiana, I put a plug in for the state here, Indiana should be very proud that it is the only state, to the best of my knowledge, with the exception of California, that has both of its major schools of business management consistently right in the top 15. Of course, California has UCLA and Berkeley, but it's the only state now, other than California, which does have this rating. I don't think many people know this.
I was not aware of it.
In the Big Ten, in my opinion, and I'm not saying this because it's located in the state, but I would say the best general school of business. Now, we don't call ourselves a general school of business. As I say, we don't provide the kinds of specialties and insurance and so forth. I happen to think is Indiana University. I would say that is probably...
Put that above Chicago, Northwestern?
Oh, well, Chicago's not in the Big Ten.
All right. I stand corrected.
Now,
Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin?
Yes. Now, I would say the Michigan has perhaps the better reputation from things that I know about as a result of my contacts at Michigan. I would say that Michigan has slipped badly in the last 5 or 6 years. Other school that you'd want to look at is Northwestern. Northwestern, of course, has done away with its undergraduate program. So in a sense, it's not no longer a general school. It's only graduate. It's in the process of completely relooking, rethinking its doctoral work, which has never been very strong.
I know Williamson and Hughes, of course, at Northwestern, so I hear about it.
They of course, are building, sort of interesting, they are building at the graduate level within the School of Business, a new department of managerial economics, and they have building it on Purdue professors, Stanley Ryder, Antonio Camacho, and now Bill Breen is joining. So it's rather interesting that essentially that
this is not the Breen of sociology.
No, this is in our school.
In your school.
So coming back, I would rate probably Indiana as the best general school of business. I would rate perhaps Northwestern program as on par with Indiana's, but as I say, it does not have an undergraduate school. Michigan consistently places in the top 10 schools. I think, I feel today that it may be somewhat overrated. Illinois has had all kinds of problems over the year. They have a new dean, and perhaps under his direction they will solve these problems. Illinois has always been very fortunate in having fine financial support. They have a fine old tradition. It's just been a real problem of trying to get the various parts together. The other schools, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, are all good schools, but I would not put them on par with what I would consider the three best: Northwestern, Indiana, Purdue, and Michigan would come in there somewhere along the line.
Michigan State has not developed, nor has Iowa?
Michigan State has developed very rapidly, but it's become almost a factory with major emphasis upon numbers. And you cannot emphasize them. For example, one of our faculty members used to be at Michigan State, and the first course in finance, 400 or 500 students. He lectures.
Excuse me.
He lectured.
We were interrupted for a moment. Has Ohio State done well?
Yes, Ohio State, I'm sorry I left Ohio State out on that. You remind me, Ohio State, from being a very mundane kind of operation, in the last 4 or 5 years as a result of a reorganization, has moved up very rapidly, and I would put Ohio State, particularly in some areas, accounting for example, as being up near the top.
Let me ask you one final question before we get to, we have two more questions, but one on general policy. Look ahead for a moment. What do you envisage the development of Purdue, or have we more or less talked about the guidelines for development of the your program?
I have just appointed a committee to look at the planning for the next 5 years for the school, all of associate professors, for I think sort of interesting reasons. They've arrived, they've got tenure, yet they haven't hardened into position. And they are the ones who perhaps are more interested in the immediate next 5 years, since it will bring with it, if they success, a successful promotion, what have you. Not having had the benefit yet of their research and findings, all I can do is operate as I see it, operate from the top of my head and as I see it. Purdue does have to face, I think, the school along with the same type of problems that the university as a whole faces, that is, Purdue School of Management. And that is, what is to be our role in the total state system? We could go right from where we are in terms of our management program either one of two ways. We could move to what I call the Carnegie Mellon approach, in which they limit their input of students each year to a rather small number for a management program. I believe it is 50. Consequently, they select extremely bright young men. Now, the process of selection, of selecting extremely bright young men, has a corollary with it that these type of people tend to want to remain in research or in academic kinds of responsibilities.
They're training then professors and research people.
Although the program is supposed to be a program for training professional managers, the kinds of people who are selected by this high intellectual quotient requirement tend to be just the kind of people who don't want to be managers, but rather want to be staff researchers, academicians, and so forth. At least this is the way it appears to me. The other approach is essentially to go to what I call the Harvard approach, where with their reputation and history, they could actually skim off the vast majority of top students who are interested in management work, or at least think they're interested in management work. However, they deliberately maintain a level of intellectual competence, at least as indicated by test scores, which is considerably less than they could if they selected the students who apply, all of the top students who apply. To put it another way, they deliberately reach down into the lower test scores and pick up students who have indicated through their college career or through work that they are entrepreneurially oriented, and bring these into their program to provide the basis, hopefully, for very good professional managers upon graduation. Now, essentially, we have, because of our limited history, been forced to follow the second approach, in a sense, because we would not be able to get the vast number of students at the top levels applying to us that Harvard has. If we continue our present approach, which is to say, to select extremely competent young men who we think will make good professional managers, we are essentially following the Harvard path. On the other hand, if we go the other way, and we can do this now, having been well enough established, we could guarantee ourselves a entering class of 50 students a year who would be extremely able would be very, very bright in terms of all measurements that can be. They're probably coming out on the average of the 93rd to 95th percentile of people who take the exam. So we have that decision. My feeling is that we ought to continue our present path. Whether the faculty believe this or not, as I say, I don't know. Certainly there are members of the faculty who I know do not believe it. The second area is the area of PhD work, I see no major change there. We have limited our PhD program, as I'm sure most programs in the campus are limited, by our ability to support it. And that support comes from two things: outside money for fellowships and teaching.
You don't do the kind of work that you would call applied research, in the sense that some company says, I want a PhD, academically respectable, but we want to, here's our problem, will you have somebody write a thesis about it?
First of all, I think you have to recognize that very few companies would approach us, we approach business schools with this kind of a question, as compared, let's say, with chemistry or physics or engineering. This would be an interesting psychological study why they don't. On the other hand, we do go out to companies. In fact, I have on my desk today three such graduate student proposals, and say, our students are working in this field. If you make the data available to us, if you provide some support, you will have given to you the results of their findings. And we do get, so in a sense, we're saying, we will tell you what the problem is we want to study. If you'll support it, you'll get some return from it. The real problem graduate schools of business and management face is that although in the last 20 years they have increased their competence in research enormously, they still are not supported by any federal grants to speak of. And companies have been very hesitant to put their money into this kind of support, as compared to putting it into specifically applied problems, I say, to come out of the engineer or the chemist or the physicist.
Well, this is, I think that answers it. Now, we're coming to the end of our interview. Are there any honors and recognitions you received that you'd like to mention at this time?
Gee, I can't say that there have been. One of the problems you face when you are the person who runs the internal organization whether it be a corporation or a school or a company, you just aren't in the forefront of the awards giving ceremonies.
Well, may I say this then, that you will append to this interview a list of your publications and election to honor societies and so on. Is there anything that anyone that particularly has made you happy?
No, not really. I'm involved in things here in campus, but this has made me very happy. At the time I accepted the deanship, I did change the relationship with my associate dean. In one major way, I felt that the need to understand what was going on in the student body was so great that I wanted a direct line of communication from our counseling staff to me, rather than through the associate dean's office, which had been previously under my regime as associate dean. I think this has paid off. I have been, in the result of a year and a half, I've been elected to a couple of student honoraries, and I have very close working relationships with the students in our school. I think this is going to continue to be of importance. I suppose if I've made any significant contribution to Purdue in the last year and a half, it's been our willingness in this school, strongly supported and in some instances led by our faculty with our black program, our program for black students. We will have, as a result of this effort, something over 100 black students registered in our school, which will be 20% of the total university enrollment, where our actual undergraduate student enrollment is only about 7 or 8%, about 8, 9% of the university. I think we have been responsible because of our pushing for some changes in the university, fellowship grant, fellowship aid, I should say, financial aids. I think Dean Ogle and I led the, shall we say, the battle to make certain changes which were done. And these kinds of things have been very rewarding, and I think have been very important to Purdue. I don't mean a tinker's dam across to professional societies, nor will I, really, in terms of the short-run future. There are a number of things happening around the country which give me pause, I think, for alarm. There is a, I've been asked to present a paper to the American Society of Mechanical Engineers on undergraduate and graduate business education next fall. And the thing I think which is becoming very, very apparent is that within our structure of business education, we are not facing up to the changes that have been made in the last 10 years. Put it another way, the undergraduate schools, where they have been supported, have flourished and increased in quality in a way that is really dramatic to anyone who knows them, the field. For example, a typical undergraduate student in business might have taken in the past, in 1955, 56, might have taken anywhere from 5 to 10 hours in lab science and mathematics. Today, in the better programs, it'll take 20 hours in this kind of work.
And yet, that includes computers.
Oh, computers would probably be good on top of that. Computer science wasn't heard of at all back in the 55s. Today, every program has at least one course required of all students, mm-hmm. and sometimes several. What's more important is the number of the courses are using computers as one of the devices for computation and analysis. But yet you find the best schools of business in the country, that's the ones with the outstanding reputations, making no differentiation in terms of the courses that the student takes upon entering the school for a student from this undergraduate program at Purdue and a student who happens to take modern languages at Purdue. And this is a travesty because the student who graduates with a BSIM essentially is a bored young man the first term at some of the very best schools. In fact, we have had one of the major universities tell us they don't want our undergraduate students because they cause so many problems. They know about half of everything they're being taught and consequently aren't very well challenged by it and consequently get into trouble one type or another. The other dilemma that we're facing that I think is also very great is the problem in the graduate schools of business around the country that are occurring with the introduction of ever-increasing numbers of discipline-oriented professors. To put it another way, the kinds of things that a student should learn and be able to accomplish as a result of his master's program, a professional master's program, which is aimed at placing him in line management, are quite different than you would expect a student to be able to accomplish and do, in many instances, halfway to a PhD. More simply, the professional man is trained to make a rather quick and dirty analysis, to bring his intuition to bear, and come up with a decision, often upon the basis of what almost anyone would claim to be insufficient evidence. Or he's involved in situations where he has too much evidence and is faced with the problem of essentially discarding much of it and operating on the basis of a completely new set of facts. One thing that he does not do is research a problem to the point at which he feels that he really can't find out anything more about it. Because that type of research, I think we all recognize, takes time, and time is usually of essence in the kinds of endeavors in which the manager finds himself. Well, as you bring more and more discipline-oriented faculty members who are very well trained in research into the business school, as I say, this is happening now, you will find, we are finding, that these men want to teach what it is they learned. And what it is they learned is very appropriate for the PhD, but generally inappropriate for the manager.
Well, the guy who has to go out and face it.
I think in quantitative methods, it shows up very clearly, where the person who has a strong, rigorous training in mathematics and statistics wants to start with the basic proofs of the theory, and will spend untold and unlimited time on these proofs, because he feels, rightfully, that building this kind of a foundation, a student would be placed in almost any situation and develop his own system of analysis. The management student, however, isn't the slightest bit interested, usually, in finding out all the proofs. He's willing to accept the fact that these have been proven by men who are experts in the field. And he wants to look at the series of developed systems to see which particular system fits the problem. In a sense, it's almost like canned programs over in the computer science center. The typical person who has to solve a problem is not at all interested in who developed the canned system, how it was developed, and the theory behind it. He accepts, as a matter of fact, that the system works, and he employs it to solve his problem. And so as we get this conflict taking place, we're discovering that the students are a little bewildered by it. On one hand, the average professor who spends all his time discussing theory is not interested in solving problems, and ends the course with an exam which requires them to do mathematical proof. The man across the way couldn't be less interested in this, in his particular course. He's teaching them intuitive analytical decision making. And the end result is, I think, a dilemma occurring in the professional school of management, which can be summed up, do we, in fact, remain a problem-solving, oriented kind of operation, or do we become a theoretically-based, formal, model-building, analytical kind of operation?
This is something that will have to be determined in the future, then.
Right. This is a major future problem.
Well, now we're nearing the end of an interview, and I know you have other things to do. Is there anything more you would like to mention?
No, I think not. As you say, I'll be given a chance to take a look at the manuscripts, and I can add in there.
Very well, then. This is the end of the interview on July the 9th, 1970, with Dean John S. Day. Thank you very much, sir.
Bob.